Great. Well, so I've got a nice and grandiose title, but I hope that I can actually coax you all to say a lot during this talk, because I made it short at Paolo's instructions. On,
but you have, instead of 15 minutes, of an hour.
Ooh, man, so I get a slightly lower grill to me talking ratio. So all the things I'm going to be presenting to you today, well, all two of them, are done with the complete group at the CFA. Alyssa Goodman's been running the project, but I really should give a shout out to Jaime Pineda and Jonathan Foster, who are two graduate students there, and they've just been wizards with the data. So I'm really grateful for all the support that they've chipped in for this project. And this is all happening under the aegis of what Alyssa likes to call the taste testing project. And she's trying to create this clearinghouse where people like me, the observers, talk to people like you who are making simulations and doing the pure thought theory, and trying to actually get these two communities talking to each other, since, they like to talk within the communities a lot. I've certainly got to admit that one of my favorite moments is going to a meeting where Ian Bennell and Mark Krumholtz are both in the audience, because it's always so entertaining. I don't understand what they're talking about, but it's really entertaining. And so it would be really nice to start talking to each other. And the taste testing project is sort of constructed with this sort of idea of the functional mapping between the domains of astronomy in mind. So we're all after reality, and you all are working very hard to simulate said reality, and it would be really nice to just do a straight comparison between those two. I'm stuck down here where reality goes through some horrible physics, then some even worse telescopes, and gives us some observations. And unfortunately, the reverse mapping from observations back to reality is never really guaranteed. You can get a few broad brush properties, but really, you know, you lose dimensionality coming down to observational domain. You've got a lot of nonlinear processes which can look like each other after a while. So you get down to observations here, and so you can't really get, I can't tell you too much about reality that you should really believe when you want to make your simulations. So the taste testing idea is just to actually complete the functional mapping and take simulations through their own radio transfer and fake telescopes into observed simulations. And the idea here is that radio transfer, while tricky to implement in practice, is at least, you know, graspable. And I can fake up a telescope pretty well because, you know, you just take nice data and do horrible things to it. And then finally, you can compare your observations in your observed simulations using a degree of statistics. And hopefully, well, similarity here doesn't tell you as much as differences here. If you see differences between these two things, you are probably not going to see, you're probably going to see differences between these two domains. So that's the idea that we're going after. So under this sort of framework, I want to talk about two things. One is a very observational data set, and that's dense cores and their ensemble properties in the Perseus molecular cloud. Then the other thing I want to talk about is a revitalization of a tool used to characterize hierarchical structure in molecular emission. And I'll get to my conclusions, and I'm going to end with a solicitation. A lot of these data sets and tools, well, both of them, all two of them, are kind of solutions looking for problems. And if you have a problem that you think would work well with some of these techniques, please talk to me. To get started, here's the Perseus molecular cloud. This is 13 CO emission, and this just gives you a sense of where all of the gas in the Perseus molecular cloud is. It's this long filamentary object. You have, you know, your famous regions. This is the IC348 cluster-forming region. NGC 1333 is going off here. So if those addresses mean anything to you, that's where they are here. And this is just, you know, what a run-of-the-mill, low-mass molecular cloud looks like. But not all of this gas is participating in the star-forming process, of course. Most of the cloud is sterile, and really what you're after is the high column density, low mass fraction portions of the cloud that are actually doing the star formation. And when you move from 13 CO to the millimeter dust continuum, this is a Bolocam map of the region, you get a much better perspective on where the actual star formation is going on. And these objects comprise the dense cores that are found in Perseus. And we'd like to know a little bit about what all of these dense cores are doing. So observations kind of traditionally go after, I'm going to look at here and, study a dense core here, and I'll do one here, and I'll do one there. But this has a lot of biases engendered in it, namely, you pick your favorite objects, you observe them, you get those results. But what does the whole population say? To kind of address that question, we went after all of the dense cores in Perseus with the Green Bank Telescope. And so we have 193 candidate objects. This is an extinction map in the background. And every red dot that you see here is a target, and all these little blue arrows are kind of field targets off outside of the main star-forming regions. And so we studied each of these 193 objects.
So how were they selected?
Oh.
Based on the
CD? No. So each of these were selected off of, go to my next one. Each of these are selected off of submillimeter emission features. So this is coming from the SCUBA and the Bolocam maps of the object.
And they surveyed the whole...
They surveyed the whole cloud. So, we can get a nice complete globe.
How do you define the core?
So, the submillimeter people define them as basically, compact Gaussian-like objects. So that's what we're calling a core. There are resolution issues, blah, 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 but that's what they're calling cores. We also did the somewhat interesting feature of, there are these Spitzer maps of the cloud, and you can take the 70 and the 160 micron and generate a best guess as to column density and temperature along each of these features, along each of these lines of sight. And we looked at low temperature, high column density features in the far infrared, kind of the things that won't show up in the submillimeter. And we added about 30 of those to our target list. And surprisingly, some of them do contain significant ammonia emission. But the gold standard for cores are where these submillimeter emission objects are. And so we have 193 targets that we went after in ammonia 1-1, 2-2, and CCS. And the interesting thing about CCS is it's an early time chemical tracer. It's formed when you build a molecular cloud, but you don't see it until you kind of cram your gas down to high densities. And so we get a good good angle on unevolved gas, whereas ammonia requires N2 to form, and N2, so Paolo Gaselli tells me, takes a long time to form, like sort of a few by 10 to the 5 years. And so ammonia only shows up in cores that have been dense for a while. So you have an early time tracer, and I should mention that CCS goes away. It gets depleted onto dust grains once you hang out in your dense state for a long time. And the other bit of information we have is what the stellar content of each of these cores are, since we have C2D imaging of this in the near and mid-infrared, so we can tell you whether a core is starless or protostellar. So I should also mention that this is a spectral survey. A lot of ammonia, ammonia studies are nice mappings of all these cores, but we didn't waste any time on the telescope. We just went to every one of our targets and took a single shot spectrum. So we really have to work with the complementary data in order to get a sense of what's going on. We don't have much radius information, for example, from the ammonia alone. All right. So,
what is the beam?
It's the GBT. It's a 30 arc second beam, which is 500th of a parsec, 0.05 parsecs. 20,000. So, here's what our data look like. I won't go into too much detail about it, but we actually do detect all our lines, and that's great. And then the other thing is that we fit this a very simple spectral model to every one of our lines. And that's we take a slab of gas, we assume it has some intrinsic line width, some uniform excitation conditions, some kinetic temperature, it's moving at some line of sight velocity. And we use this model to actually fit all of our lines simultaneously. And we actually, the exciting thing is that we get a good fit for, a relatively simple profile like this. We didn't get too fancy. The reason is that we have 193 objects and we wanted to use the same analysis method on every object. And there's a lot of objects that this just completely sucks for. And, you know, in the future, we'll go ahead and we'll take a better look at that. But for now, all we're interested in is sort of this monolithic model, which is used to generate a set of properties. And we pull out kinetic temperature, line width, how fast it's going along the line of sight, the opacity, the excitation temperature. And combining those five properties, we can pull out the ammonia and CCS column densities. And then we really have to leverage our dust continuum observations. And where we have dust continuum data, we can pull out the radius of the cores. And with the kinetic temperature and some somewhat dubious assumptions about the opacity of dust at 1.1 millimeters, we can get the mass of the cores too. So I'm showing you this map to just show you, you might wonder, well, how well does the ammonia gas that we're tracing really relate to the dust continuum? The answer is pretty well, but not, you know, it's not 100%.
Is this your map then?
Yes.
So you did one map there.
So this is Andrew Walsh's data. They weren't able to reduce it. I went into the GBT archive, pulled it through. Spent a caffeinated weekend and figured out how to reduce it. So it's my map, but their data. Anyways, so this is NGC 1333 in ammonia. And the contours in the color image trace the same thing here. So we do have one map here. And we can see that there's bright features. And then there's this sort of low surface brightness emission dense gas around the entire cluster. Now I can compare that to the Bolochem map of the same region. And you see there's, well, there's fairly good agreement on a broad scale between the millimeter emission and the ammonia. Bright things in the millimeter are bright in ammonia. The relative brightness has changed. Like here's an object down here that's faint in the millimeter continuum, but pretty bright in ammonia. And you don't see any of this sort of diffuse intra-cluster gas.
And the film to the left is young stuff, maybe.
Then. Here? Yeah. Oh, no. This particular feature here is thought to be a local heating of the dust by, you know, there's a bright cluster of stars here. So it we're a little worried that it's that, because it doesn't have CCS emission there either. We actually have a spectral pointing there. So this is one of those bizarrely weak features. But in 98% of our Bolochem sources, we get very strong ammonia emission or CCS emission. So in general, we do a pretty good job. And we can use our spectra and then the objects identified in the Bolochem map and just sort of tag every millimeter core with a line of sight velocity, line width, kinetic temperature, etc. So, what does this sort of shaky inversion back to the physical domain tell you? One thing that we can do is, since we have a line width out of ammonia, and we have a kinetic temperature, we can immediately write down what the thermal and the non-thermal components of the line width are. So this is just the plot of those two components against each other for the cores that we can measure those two things well for. So we have thermal, then the non-thermal. This line here is the locus of equality, and nearly all of our cores sit close to but below the locus of equality. So they're thermally dominated.
What's your velocity resolution? The
error bars are very small. Our velocity resolution is 30 meters per second. And we can centroid in some of our cores to centimeters per second. Completely useless precision, but you know, we can do quite well. The issues are that there are error bars with the uncertainties are more due to the fit in cases where our stupid model doesn't do a good job of approximating what's going on. And the upper limits that I've shown here are actually cases where the stupid model is obviously breaking down. And in fact, all of our high line width objects up here, where we have a significant turbulent velocity dispersion, when we look at them and we have very high signal to noise, we see that one large broad feature actually resolves into multiple components along the line of sight. So it seems that every large line width feature in our data is actually the line of sight confusion of several narrow line features. And that's something that we come to only because we have signal to noise of 400 or 500 in some cases.
So do you try to fit the single component? Or what do you do?
We, in those, I just tag them with a with a upper limit. In cases where the two components are well separated, we fit each separately, assuming that we don't do any transfer through each other. We assume that the filling fraction of the two components is less than unity within the beam. And so we don't put one in front of the other. They're just both hanging out. And so that'll fit 6 out of 193 of our objects. The rest we sort of say, well, this is some grad student's thesis project. And Patrick?
You see that there is a quite large number of multiple lines just by eye. Okay? Is that compatible with what you expect from random distributions?
I haven't looked into that in too much detail, but there's definitely there are a large number of features where we really don't have a good handle on it, and this is even excluding all of the low signal to noise stuff, which tends to have the really wiggy line profiles, and in those cases we don't get the 2-2 line, and so we don't get a handle on what the temperature is.
Well, of the black points, some of those are also those where you actually were able to fit the, say, two components.
Yeah, a couple of them are. I don't remember which ones.
A couple, okay.
But
and typically, are there two components, three? How many are there?
There are almost, when we can fit, it's almost two. When we get to, like, three component things, it's too confused to really pick stuff out.
So those upper limits sound to be either three or four components?
It could be, yeah, it could be very high. The other ones are not a lot of times you'll see like an ammonia profile with a large wing and you don't know, well, is that some sort of infall profile or is that a second component along the line of sight? This is the kind of thing that we actually have an accepted proposal at the GBT to go after a lot of these confused systems and map them, because the position information will give you a lot more information about these multiple components, because, you know, hopefully you'll have something that's a blend will resolve into one system at one position and another system at another position.
But using just the submillimeter, what is the resolution in the submillimeter data?
It's actually comparable, 30 arc seconds.
So from the submillimeter map, you wouldn't be able to see that each of those guys is actually 2 or 3 pieces?
Almost all of the ones that are... anywhere we have an obvious multiple components, it's very easy to see, okay, this is a blend, with some exceptions. And this is actually a sort of cautionary tale about just using the submillimeter. We have one great case of a perfectly round submillimeter core isolated with two velocity components on it, separated by 0.5 kilometer per second. So it can be dangerous to use just the submillimeter to identify
cores. But in the other cases, you think that the observers would have actually broken most of those arrows into at least two objects?
Most of the cases, yeah. Most of the cases, you know that these arrows are hanging out in confused regions.
Okay, so you could say that only maybe not more than 5 or 10%
right.
of the submillimeter selected cores are not.
Yeah. I would say that you don't have to, you know, chuck Mott and Andre or whoever out the window, because not all of the cases where the ammonia tells you something is scary, you would believe that you aren't doing a great job decomposing. Anyways. So on a related note, this kind of poorly ties into what was talked about yesterday. We actually, since we've tagged every one of these submillimeter cores with a velocity, we can measure the relative velocity differences between these cores. And I know that a lot of the simulation thrust that's going on in this room isn't really concerned too much with the actual, you know, formation of the cores and their relative motions. But in general, a lot of people are sort of concerned about how are these cores moving with respect to each other. And so what I've plotted here is that I've binned up the mean velocity difference between pairs of cores as a function of separation. And I put this on a log scale so that you can actually, you can just see that, well, for, you know, and then I've separated this into clusters, which is IC348 and NGC1333, and then field cores, which are everywhere else in the cloud. And you can see that there is some manner of correlation that might be expressed as a power law, maybe not, in both of these data sets. But you do definitely see a rising velocity separation for increasing spatial separation. Of course, there's a dimensionality argument or a dimensionality confusion with respect to like what the true three-dimensional real structure functions are. But this particular measurement would be very easy to make without having to worry too much about rate of transfer and stuff out of a Baten-Bonnell core simulation. And you can just slap it on here. The other thing that's interesting is that the cluster versus the field cores, the cluster cores have a larger intrinsic velocity separation for a fixed spatial scale.
Have you actually tried to do kind of a power law fit to this structure function?
Yeah, so I did that, and then I was like, well, you know, a real structure function is like, it's three dimensions, and this is like, this is two dimensions, and this is one dimension, so I'm not entirely sure how it works out. But this slope is about a third. This slope is about a half, and oh, it's perfect.
Take data from three-dimensional simulations and project the velocity field to the two-dimensional and then compute structure functions again. So there's some possibility of comparison.
Exactly. I mean, this seems like a point that we can easily talk about. You know, the simulation and the observers can talk about, and so that's why I wanted to construct this particular diagram. I'd like to comment a little bit about this break here. It does seem like it. We take off towards sort of, you know, a steeper slope here, and this may be the result of Perseus, may not be one large molecular cloud, but several smaller molecular features kind of stretched out along a larger cloud formation event. And this one parsec scale is kind of the characteristic size of the individual blobs within Perseus, the L1448 region, the NGC1338 region. That's all about one parsec. And then this is just tracing the velocity separation between those blobs.
And you know that in the cluster regions, the line with the gas is larger, right? So
right.
It's okay, the normalization is
good. I haven't tried to normalize it, or rather, I haven't tried to normalize this plot, but when I did a previous version, it actually brought them to about the same thing as you would expect. If you just normalize by the total gas velocity dispersion. One thing that I've been wanting to do is to actually do like a PCA style analysis on the 13CO and overlay the derived structure function from that on here to see whether the cores are sort of, you know, just moving broadly with the 13CO gas, or whether they're
more flowy, right?
They should be, yeah. I mean, these are, you know, on a one parsec scale, this is, you know, 0.5 kilometers per second, and then, you know, the gas should be up about one in a bit.
But regarding doing this in the simulation, mm-hmm. You said initially that you look at those two tracers, and one is younger than the other.
Yeah.
But then, so in this point, you always detect both tracers, though?
Most of the time, yeah.
Most of the time. Mm-hmm. And they're in the same ratio, the line-length ratio, are they the same?
Sorry, which ratio?
need to try to estimate the relative abundance of those two.
The relative abundance has changed significantly. And this change in relative abundance is one of the ways that you hope to date cores. I don't have this in here, but we can compare like the column density of these two tracers for the stellar and the protostellar, the stellar and the starless cores. And as you would expect, you have a much higher CCS abundance in starless cores versus protostellar.
But it wouldn't matter because this is, you know, the core, the Bernoulli's dispersion is subsonic, and the velocity, the relative velocity is supersonic. Then the error might not, everything for the core area should be too large, right?
Right.
The chemistry is relevant because you select them as some millimeter cores. So we can select them in the simulation just because they're density, essentially.
Exactly. No, any high column density feature, you could just pick it out. We looked at the difference between the ammonia and the CCS velocities for all our cores, and it's negligible. It's consistent with zero with some small spread around it. So all of these dense gas tracers are sort of coming with the core, and so picking out the different tracers doesn't really give you different kinematic information. They seem, it's more important which core you're looking at rather than which tracer.
But we can make it some millimeter math, so we select them like correctly. Yeah, because otherwise we'll just like just dense stuff. I mean, they're not necessarily.
Right. No. And making a submillimeter map is pretty easy, right?
Yeah.
You just column density.
Well, I don't know exactly.
Well, yeah. So the last thing I want to talk about in this particular study, I mean, we've made all kinds of plots, but I tried to give you the three most interesting ones. But we can get a sort of cartoon perspective on the dynamical state of dense cores. And that's, I've expressed this in terms of comparing the dynamical mass estimates versus the luminous mass estimates for all of these cores. I'm getting the luminous mass estimate from the dust continuum. So this is dust opacity, radius, and temperature from the ammonia observations. And you assume that the dust and the gas are thermally coupled. So that'll give you an estimate of what the dust masses are going. And then I can get a dynamical estimate from the size of the core from the submillimeter, the line width from the ammonia observations. That's all I need if I assume it's a uniform sphere because everything is a uniform sphere. And then I also can split this into two populations as to whether they have a star inside them or not. And, of course, this has nothing fancy in it, no external pressures, no magnetic fields, nothing like that. But doing that, I actually get fairly good correlation between these two cartoon mass estimates. The poor choices of colors on this scheme, on this projector, fail to indicate that most of the protostellar cores lie here along the locus of equality, which is what you would expect if the cores were in virial equilibrium without any external pressure. Whereas the dashed line here is up by a factor of 2, so that's the locus they should follow if their internal kinetic energies balance their gravitational energy. So they're this is the marginally bound line in this simple phrasing. And most of the starless cores sit, you know, scatter around the marginally bound line. So I can't tell you whether this is cause or effect, like whether this is, you know, whether these starless cores will always remain starless because they don't get down to the, you know, they don't get down to be self-gravitating enough, or whether these the starless population will evolve onto the protostellar. But it gives us a good sense that pressure, the external pressure, isn't too important on the cores that are protostellar here.
Okay, I have a bunch of questions.
Yay!
First of all, the dynamical mass, and this is like the virial mass for a uniform sphere in the line width?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
With nothing else.
Yeah.
It's a uniform sphere.
Yeah, so I mean, a factor of two error is at least what you would expect.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's okay, that's the scale for a factor of two after all.
Uh-huh. And, you know, we haven't done anything fancy. And, you know, I think that, you know, it's the same model applied to everything. So maybe the, you know, these differences could be attributed to the protostellar cores having a different set of assumptions that should go into the model.
Okay, the mass from on the subnivator, how is that computed?
That's just, it's...
I mean, depends. What temperature do you assume?
We assume the ammonia temperature.
The ammonia temperature?
Yeah. So we can, every core has a unique temperature.
What is the typical density of this core?
Typical volume density is like 10 to the 4.
Borderline.
Yeah. Okay. But they don't get too much above it in our cases, and they don't get too much below it.
What is the typical temperature you find? Or is it
10 to 15 Kelvin, mean is 11. 15, 10 to 15. And the mean is 11.
Okay, 10 to 15, maybe it's a little cold. I think the dust would be a little warm, right?
Sure.
Which will bring you a little. Jose, you don't know where the temperature. You don't know, for example, if there's a correlation between mass and temperature. That would be nice to know.
I can check that.
It looks like
pretty easily.
Those points, that's horizontal. That's
exactly. Bring these down or something.
If mass is correlated with temperature, and if temperature is the main source of error.
Yeah. So a breakdown of our assumption that the gas and dust are well coupled would give that to us. Right. You had a bunch. That was only two.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's not obvious that all the black points are derived from the blue.
No. And they are commingled. There's a couple black points up here. It's just, on average, the blue points sit higher than the black points.
Aren't there too many starlets versus protostellar compared to other, what we hear, that most cores are starless? Most cores are... Fewer cores are starless, so that time is short. What is the dominant ratio that you hear in the certificate?
I don't actually know.
This argument has been made a few times in the literature, right? That cores evolve very rapidly because the ratio of a starless core to...
There are very few starless cores relative to protostellar.
Like half or more. The reduction of the people time that we actually...
Right. Okay, so... So if you find 50-50 is...
So before you read too much into it, I warn you that there are selection effects here. Namely, I'm plotting only those points for which I can measure all the properties involved.
Okay.
And so there's, you know, this trims it down to about 50 of our original sample, based on, you know, we don't have submillimeter emission for some of the cores, we don't have 2-2 emission for other one of the cores, we can't resolve the line, or it's one of these multiple line blending affairs. So, warning about selection effects. We can't say too much. All I'm telling you is that for the cores that we measure, you know, I've also completely swept error bars under the rug. But
why don't you have some millimeter for some cores?
Because some of our sources were these far infrared, high column density objects that we looked at, and there's ammonia emission associated with them. 1-1, 2-2, no submillimeter.
But this is because they were outside of the submillimeter field?
No. These are in the submillimeter field, not detected. No submillimeter flux. I mean, that could be that they're just weak in the submillimeter, but that would imply if the ratio of the ammonia column density to the dust column density were like the other cores that we detect, then we should have seen them in the submillimeter. However, it's more indicative that there is like dense gas hanging out there that hasn't really had any submillimeter emission associated with it. And on average, all of these sort of, you know, bizarre ammonia detections are hot, low column density features. So there the temperatures are like 18 to 20 Kelvin as opposed to this 10 to 15. So this could just be dense gas that's... I don't know what it is, because you should have formed it.
Why shouldn't all the ones you don't see in submillimeter be hot or warmer?
Well, I guess all the ones that we can detect the 2-2 emission in, they tend to be very weak features. As a result, we don't get temperatures on them very easily.
So they're probably not in there.
Yeah, so none of those features are here because we don't have a radius from the submillimeter. Ooh. Good description. All right. I can tell you a lot more about ammonia, but I want to pick your brains about how to characterize hierarchical structure in molecular cod emission. And for those of you who were at the conference, Alyssa Goodman talked a little bit about this. But this is a this is an isosurface rendering of L1448, which is a little blob of gas in Perseus. And this is again in the 13CO. And there are three nested surfaces being shown here. You have sort of high brightness isosurfaces here. You have this purple isosurface at a medium intensity that kind of lasses them all together. Then you have this green surface, which sort of encompasses the whole feature. So this is kind of what a molecular cloud looks like. And then back when I was sort of putting all of this stuff together, Paolo was kind enough to send me one of UL's simulations using the using your ENSO code. And sorry?
If it is from ENSO, that's it.
All right. Well, thanks. Yeah, so everything, I warn you, I'm probably going to say Paolo simulations at some point, or Padoan simulation. And of course, this is shorthand for the combined work, you know, using the radiative transfer, the full simulation, and I've just been citing Paolo because that's the reference I have in the literature, and I don't want to slight anybody here. So thank you all for your simulations and your radiative transfer work. It's spot on. So what I did was I took this glorious simulation and I ran it through the FCRAO 14-meter telescope and did horrible things to it. I added a bunch of noise that was correlated, and you know, I degraded the resolution and put in, you know, all kinds of like baseline wiggles and fun stuff, and got out a data cube that actually kind of looks like the original simulation because it was relatively high quality data. And so you have the same three isosurfaces drawn at the same three levels here. And so this is just what a simulation cube looks like. And I'd like to go after the hierarchical structure of these two data sets. Now, the industry standard is to sort of throw clump finder Gauss clumps at it. And basically what these things do is they balkanize your emission. They divide it up into tiny little clumps around the local maxima. And then you can actually get somewhere by characterizing the population of clump properties over the molecular cloud. But you know, originally clump find was intended to go after and identify star-forming clumps or structure within molecular clouds. And I think the consensus has finally evolved to a point where it's, you know, that's not what it's actually useful for. But I'd like to, I don't know, in the words of many politicians, I'd like to be a uniter and not a divider. And so what I'm going to go after is just, I'm not going to try to divide it into objects, but I'm actually going to try to take this hierarchical structure and just characterize it and try to come up with useful statistics about it. And so what I've been forwarding is this idea of using dendrograms, which are actually just structure trees that Houlihan and Scalo wrote about in 1993. But dendrograms turns out to be what all the other fields call these particular objects. So I'm going to toe their line and work with that. So the idea with a dendrogram is you have this one-dimensional emission profile here in the black. And I'm going to abstract it down to its essential features. And I only care about two things. I only care about the local maxima, as shown here with these little spikes here. And I only care about the contour levels that I draw that take two separate local maxima and enclose them in a single surface. So if I'm just marching down this emission profile, I have two features. And then at this contour level, they merge together into a single feature. So I'm going to mark that here by just joining these two branches together. I can continue that process and do that, you know, for every local maximum in the field. And I've reduced this tedious emission profile to the skeleton here. And I'm going to call the top branches of the dendrogram leaves. All the vertical segments I'll refer to generically as branches. The bottom thing is the root, and where two things join are nodes. I think I get to say all of those words. So here's what a dendrogram of emission looks like. Well, maybe it's not so useful. But you can see that, you immediately pick out that you have a peak of emission at 8 Kelvin, But you actually have to drop down 4 Kelvin before it joins with any other features. You have this large structure here, which actually, that peak corresponds to this little blob here. And then you go all the way down to this level here, to 1 Kelvin, and that's where this purple surface is joined. And that gathers up another sort of high velocity feature here. I've looked at this a lot, so you're not supposed to be getting everything out of this that I'm telling you. And this actually gathers up a high velocity feature, which is this. So this is, if you will, this is kind of the merger history of the emission as you drop through contour levels. And
this is done in 3D now.
This is done in 3D. Yes. Yeah, so these are three-dimensional contours, and I care about where those contours lasso in other pieces of emission.
Nothing confused. So this dendrogram is like something one-dimensional, right?
Of
emission profiles. So how can you get a connection to the element?
Oh, okay.
So how can we say this feature is just quite obvious?
Okay, so I look at that because I know where, so I keep track of the three-dimensional coordinates of where every one of these local maxima sit, so that I know, and I can actually, every point in this dendrogram corresponds to an isosurface in three dimensions. This is the 7 Kelvin isosurface, which only contains this local maximum. This branch represents the 2 Kelvin isosurface, which contains this population of local maximum. And so the dendrogram doesn't contain that, but all the information I'm pulling along as I run the algorithm actually tracks which isosurfaces. Well, all you really need are the value of the isosurface and the coordinates of the local maxima, and you can actually map between these two spaces. No problem. Oh, I haven't done this. Yeah, this is all being done in position velocity space.
Okay, right.
Yeah. Yes. So we stay in observed space. I'm running the three-dimensional one now, like the true density field and stuff like that. But there's an awful lot of information there. It takes a long time.
That's what the microamp algorithm does, actually. I didn't know it was called metagram, but so we build a tree that is exactly your tree.
Right.
We keep track of all the coordinates. So if we hit the isosurface, when you reach the node, then precisely in my compound algorithm, that has a surface that defines the mass of the object above that.
Right.
And the only thing is that we select, we only keep the rotationally bound one on top. We don't build the hierarchy, but you keep all the hierarchy.
Yeah.
And so you could use that to define, velocity size relation
Right. And that's what we try to do, which is, as I mentioned, every one of these points is an isosurface and with a maximum inside it. So you can calculate the physical properties associated with that. You calculate the amount of emission contained within that, or in the real case, you can calculate the density or the total mass within these surfaces and stuff like that. So I can pull out the luminosity within an isosurface, and that'll give me some tracer of the mass. I know its angular extent, so that'll give me a size. I know its line width. Its velocity extent, so I can characterize its line width. So for every one of these points here, I can calculate a line width, a size, and a luminosity, all the way down from the tip to the root for one particular branch, and I can do that for every set of isosurfaces and every set of local maxima in this, and sort of calculate properties for every point along this dendrogram. And then I can explore what those properties are doing. So this is kind of, I've formed a, given the line width, the radius, and the luminosity, I'm forming the virial parameter for each of these points in the dendrogram. And I've color-coded each point here with a sharp break at 2, which is the difference between self-gravitating and unbound. And you can see, so, you know, cartoonishly, a lot of these branches out here are, you know, they're not self-gravitating. I mean, please understand that there's a lot shoved under the rug right here. Bear with me. But, you know, a lot of these branches here are sterile, but a few of these have significant chunks of self-gravitating material along them. The tops of the branches are missing because you don't have enough points up there to calculate properties well. So you can see, okay, well, here's some self-gravitating regions. Then this portion of the tree looks, well, it's all below 2. And I can actually mask that and select only those objects where the virial parameter is less than 2. And that's these portions of the dendrogram highlighted here in red.
What is the portion? I don't understand. Because between two isosurfaces is actually bound, but both a higher density, higher brightness, or a lower.
Okay. If I have an isosurface, calculate the properties, it's bound. But if I drop down to a slightly lower isosurface, maybe I shove out pretty far in radius or something like that. We aren't calculating sort of the region between two isosurfaces. This is always what's contained within, right?
So I think. So if you measure, so sometimes we measure within an isosurface, and you get this bound.
Right.
But sometimes you measure just a piece of it inside that, and it may be unbound.
Right.
Okay, I see.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's in a very real sense, what this is characterizing is the general shape of these isosurfaces in position velocity space relative to the luminosity, in that if they're too big in position velocity without enough luminosity, they don't show up as bound.
So the bottom size, that's the isosurface is where you would say that's the largest size that is bound to that form.
Exactly.
For each branch is the bottom.
Right. So you can use this to say, well, you know, you can use this to sort of characterize, okay, well, what's the, you know, are these objects bound on this large scale here? What about on the small scale? And, you know, all these little branches up here have some self-gravitating structure, but also this entire object here has significant self-gravity over it. So one thing that we are going after is sort of self-gravitation on a multitude of scales, not just on the smallest objects. And the reason we want to do this is that ClumpFind is renowned for only studying the smallest scales. If we constructed a similar diagram for what ClumpFind would do, there'd be no grouping of each of these branches. They would just go straight down to 0 in every case. So it'd be like a picket fence of ClumpFind features. With no care about how these two join. So this is one way that we've been looking at it. I'm getting ready to hit the slide, so if you have questions.
Okay, can I ask you something?
Yeah.
Just to visualize, if you pick all the branches and just make a 3D plot, what does that look like? I mean, just the self-gravitating part.
Oh, okay. So that corresponds to this outer scale here, corresponds to the sort of purplish surface that you see coming through here.
I'm just talking about the path that you marked red.
That I marked red. Yeah. Yeah. So, okay.
For the higher ones.
Right. I mean, it's hard to, yeah. I'd have to exclude the sterile branches then, which is hard to render. I think it would be a very patchy since
you have a different surface for each object.
Yeah.
So it's tough to visualize.
Yeah, it would be ugly.
Well, you cannot just visualize by it. So you have to really clean the data and then visualize it. You can't just do your visualization.
Right. You'd have to, yeah.
But presumably each point in that 3D map is a point in this diagram, right?
Each point is contained, yeah. So the points over here, the abstraction here is that every point here is a volume in the three-dimensional space. It's a surface containing a volume. So one point, say the local maximum, is actually contained within all these surfaces. So, yeah, I guess that's a succinct way of putting it that I've never thought of before, is that, you know, what the dendrogram is it's a plot of surface characteristics. So, the dendrogram is also entirely governed by the set of local maxima with which you initialize it. And so I've actually heavily filtered that set of local maxima to generate the figures you've seen heretofore. However, I can turn down those criteria, and still, you know, these are reasonable local, number of local maxima. But you actually pick up a much richer set of structure once you sort of allow a little more noise, or the possibility of a little more noise in here. The interesting thing that I like to see is that the gross structure of the dendrogram remains the same. One big large branch with a side branch here turns into one big large branch with a side branch. But there's structure on every one of those. And then I can compare that to the simulation. And you know, you can see, well, it looks different, but how different is it? Sorry? Oh, so it's normalized by the number of nodes in each diagram. Is that what you're asking?
Why don't they have larger surface brightness up to 8, for example, in the simulation?
That's what came out of the radio transfer cube. This is not the density field. This is the what I think you told me was the 13 CO emission data cube.
This was one of your simulations.
Yeah, this was one of Mika's cubes.
But it was not that on 1024.
No, it was separate.
Oh, okay. So
no.
Because the cubes you handed me were 256. Were they downsampled? They were 256 cubed, was like the density and the velocity field that I have. And then the PPV cube that I have is like 256 squared by 1,000 channels or something like that.
But that must have been on an MHD simulation, right? I don't think you've ever done a deep transfer on a pure hydro. So it's probably an MHD simulation, it's not a Alexis, right?
Okay.
Could you give us more information about the
It must have been a standard, our standard superalbanic, like non-self-gravitating. And the initial beta will be close to 1, and then the Alban Mach number will be after 3 after the
Mach.
It will be 10 in the beginning and then down to 3 when the magnitude is amplified later.
What are you assuming for the distribution of the residence here?
It's always constant, right, Mika?
Yeah. It's constant throughout the
Yeah, we have to look at chemistry.
Yeah, because I mean, yeah. The results I showed you last week, you're going to get a lot of scatter from that, which is not in the simulation.
But how do you get larger surface brightness? Because what do you need to do to get larger surface brightness?
I don't know how you're going to get larger surface brightness, but you're certainly going to get more scatter.
Maybe higher resolution, because when you downsample from 1,050 to 256, and then sub-gravity, you create, the typical maximum density in 1,000 cube Rand Mach 10 is a few hundred or 500 most.
Mm-hmm.
When you turn on sub-gravity, even regions that do not collapse, eventually, they are able to not collapse, you easily reach density of 1,000 or 2,000, so 4 times larger. And
right.
So that will be quite a good contribution for sub-gravity to get those scatter.
It's worth saying at this point, and I think I neglected, I don't know that these two are fair comparisons. I'm just kind of putting them up next to each other, since I don't know whether the simulation is appropriate to model an L1448. I mean, that's, it's hard to compare them. And then the other thing is that, yes, the span of brightness temperatures is different in these two two observation sets, but you didn't need dendrograms to tell you that. A simple PDF of brightness distributions will say, these two are different, and I don't have to bend over backwards to construct these trees when one-sided KS test will do, or two-sided. So What I'm more interested in is if anybody, you know, looks at this hierarchy and is like, well, obviously what you need to do is calculate mean number of parent-children ratios and sort of spans, and it's a good way to distinguish two sets of trees like this. I'd be curious to hear it. I've been dickering around with a bunch of statistics to try to, you know, characterize trees like this, because, you know, I can show you these things and you'll say, oh, they're different, but, you know, what your eye and what numbers tell you are two different things.
Interpretation what these two major branches are corresponding to?
This is a high velocity feature relative to the main cloud that you basically have to go down to 1.5 Kelvin to find an isosurface that contains both features.
But is it really true that the best way to do it is in 3D? Why not on the reflected field? I mean, I can understand you throw away information if you don't do it in 3D.
Right.
But at the same time,
if they're not the same, if you find differences between a given statistic using 3 dimensions, but no differences when you look in 2 dimensions, I mean, wouldn't that say that the loss of information is in fact crucial at that point?
Yeah.
I'll skip this, but one thing that I have found interesting use for dendrograms are that I actually kind of believe is identifying giant molecular clouds. And this is the 12CO map of the Orion Molecular Complex, wide field object. And, you know, anybody who's been staring at this for a while will tell you this is Orion A, this is Orion B, and this is some other stuff. But when you actually observe it with this nice data set, like this Wilson et al. Data, all of these objects, you know, GMCs are commonly identified as, oh, I'm gonna clip my data set at 3 sigma or 4 sigma and count connected objects, and those are my GMCs. But this has nice exquisite noise, so if you do that at 4 sigma or what have you, you get basically this entire feature here is merged into one object. And, you know, that's not what the GMCs are. But what dendrograms do is they give us an opportunity to characterize this entire emission set in terms of these regions of self-gravitation. And you can objectively define GMCs as the outer scale of self-gravitating objects in these features. And it picks out the emission associated with Orion A. You can follow this tree down until it terminates here. And here's Orion B, and that terminates there. And these objects are bound within each other, but not bound to each other. So you can actually pick out the GMCs pretty well here. So that's something that I'm interested in. The issue is that you need a high signals to noise data set where all the objects are at the same distance, which are few and far between, because you can go to other galaxies, but there's low signals to noise. Or you can look in our own galaxy where everything's at different distances. So, again, a tool that's looking for a problem. So.
What is for trapezium blasting the video
feature? Trapezium is here.
That's Orion A, is it?
Orion A, yeah.
So where's the edge?
Yeah. It's right here at this in this bright feature. And then Orion A has this huge, you know, the so trapezium is what, Ori D or whatever in Blau. So these are the where the older generations of star formation have gone off. And that's this these holes. So, there you have it. We know a lot about the ensemble properties of dense cores in Perseus. So we're certainly looking for things to examine in more detail. We certainly see that they really appear to their internal motions are thermally dominated, and we have some degree of a velocity structure function that would be really great to test with other simulations. And then for this hierarchical structure, it's very half-baked. We're really looking for things to do with it, and I'd welcome any suggestions you have about how we can take our nice tool and apply it to other things. So I'll be here till Friday.
Of the
parameter for the color table.
Yeah.
The copy and yes. So you go down to one is very, so there is nothing below one with few exceptions at the top left.
Yeah, and this is these tips are kind of where things where the calculated properties are sketchiest. These are, you know, there's 10, 12 actual voxels contributing to this measurement, so there's large noise. I probably should extend the exclusion bars a little bit.
But then the whole structure will be the bottom right, right?
Right.
So the whole cloud is like 4.
Yeah. So the entire data cube, there is, you know, out to here, this feature is all sort of bound into one object. And then this has some, you know, this is bound here, but
so then you can bound so you can prove here that Perseus is not one molecular cloud.
Well, this hasn't encompassed all of Perseus either.
Oh, this is just one.
This is the L1448 region.
Oh, I see. But if you did it for the old Perseus, you definitely get interrupted in many places, right?
Yeah, let's see if I can find that. Oh, you know. So, my So this is all of Perseus.
Five pieces, right?
Yeah, thorough chunks. So, yeah, here we aren't seeing Perseus being bound to itself, really. Yeah. Do you have a question, Patrick?
Yeah. How many pixels do you have in the chemap, and how sensitive the results to the resolutions? If you smooth out your data by say factor 2 or 4, how is pictures?
So the nice thing about the dendrograms is that as the critical element is which local maxima you established. And smoothing the data out, you know, they may blur local maxima or move their positions, but you'll generally improve the noise and actually let you keep the same set of local maxima. And then the actual topology of the isosurfaces will change somewhat. So the shapes of the trees will change a little, but not a lot, is my contention. This stands in contrast with like a strict segmentation algorithm where you're going to get very different results depending on your resolution and stuff like that. So I'm not going to say it's completely independent, but I'm going to say it's more robust than if you were going after this with a watershed algorithm.
How many cells, you know, pixels are here?
For this?
Yeah.
A couple million?
Because, I mean, the difficulty that if you want, I mean, at some stage, compare with, say, simulations, you need actually to have more than 1 million in projection 2D, which is more than 1 million into the line. And more is significantly more because you don't want just to have the element, you want to solve the physics of the element.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I think that fortunately, you know, in this sort of idea of bringing things to an observational space, the simulations can be brought down to sort of match the resolutions here, and thus maybe not have the same physical, you know, similarities, but at least be engaged in the same lies as the observations are engaged in.
But it's not true because simulation, to be honest, they like if you look at the velocity field, the far spectra, you get, you dissipate turbulence at k equal, I mean, at intermediate scales, you know. So, to be honest, to really match an observation where there is no numerical diffusivity, you should actually cut your simulations at, you know, pretty bad. So 1,000 cube will be reduced barely to 256 if you want to have a power spectrum that is barely a power load the way down.
So we actually need to, I think we are fed there to match this size of survey, if you want.
When you draw the power spectrum, obviously, but the
my loss. I think that the last decay you can
sort of. The last decay
is completely dominated by the.
Yeah, exactly. So when you say I did 1,000 cube, but when you did 100 cube, really, if you really wanted to have no numerical dissipation, so you could compare with that, because there is no numerical dissipation, the power spectrum are perfect power loss. So then you should actually run 1,000 cube to compare with the 200 cube map. And then you cannot trust the velocity field below because it's so much dissipated, right?
Yeah, that's why it's very good.
Then I think that this survey, like the complete survey of Perseus, is large compared with what you can do in this simulation.
I understand the dendrogram is good enough, but have you done similar analysis using another algorithm, for example, a quantum fund or something like that?
Yeah, there's sort of a parallel effort going on to examine compare these simulations to observations using quantum fund, and it's gotten bogged down in understanding how difficult quantum fund is to use. The main feature we've come across so far is that the mass distribution of clumps is determined entirely by the input parameters pi clump find. And if you set them to one thing, you get a Salpeter IMF, and you set them to the other, you get an EMC IMF. And that's interesting, probably, but it also suggests that using clump find is kind of subtle.
Do you have some figure showing comparison between them?
Between this and Compon?
Yes.
So I think it's important to not as such. And the reason is that Compon is a segmentation algorithm.
Any figure will not look like that.
Uh-huh. So
do you have any result showing the difference between the result of using these two different algorithms?
Right. So I don't, and the reason is that it is you can't really compare the results of this algorithm to clump fine, since clump fine is a segmentation algorithm, whereas this is just a reduction. It's an abstraction of the total data view.
Unless you decide, you could get a mass distribution here if you decided that some criterion. Numerically what we do is subgravitating or not.
Right.
You could do the same.
Man, that would be lovely. Yeah.
So you could.
Right. And so the question is, do you double count?
We don't, because.
Yeah.
But you could.
Well, you.
Yeah, because you know what's going on.
If you're interested in defining the hierarchical structure, then
exactly.
You can still there.
Right.
So that's great. We're going to lunch at the cafe, if anybody wants to join, otherwise, thank you again.